Welcome to Theology Thursday. I'm Nicole McBurney. Every weekday, we bring you the news of the day, the culture, and science from a Christian worldview. Today, join me and Pastor Bob Enyart as he explores the source of our Christian worldview, the Bible.
When the Hebrew scriptures were translated into Greek so that the Roman world could read, because the Roman world didn't read Hebrew. So at the request of a librarian in Alexandria in Egypt, about 70 rabbis in Jerusalem worked to translate the Hebrew scriptures, what we call the Old Testament, into Greek. They did so. We call that the Septuagint. When they did that, having a large scroll is extremely expensive. Even today, if you're going to print a 1,400-page book, that's going to cost a lot of money. So we'll create volumes, volume 1, 2, 3, sort of like Lord of the Rings. Tolkien wrote it as one book. And the publisher during World War II, he said, "Are you crazy? There's not that much paper in all of Britain." So he published it in three volumes. So the Septuagint, they decided to break up Samuel, the book of Samuel, into two. They did the same with Kings, the same with Chronicles. They did the same with Ezra and Nehemiah. And so what is important is that the text is the same. So we think of 2 Samuel, and we might downplay Samuel's role in that, because here's Nathan talking to David, but it really is Samuel, the book of Samuel. And so, and by the way, Samuel is the prophet most identified with Israel's kingdom. We learn that in Acts chapter 3, although it's a bit subtle, but we see that beginning with Samuel and all the prophets who follow. It's like, why did Peter begin with Samuel? What was Moses? What was Enoch? Chopped liver? I mean, why begin the list of the prophets with Samuel? Well, it's because Peter was talking about the kingdom, Israel's kingdom. And if you're talking about the prophets of the kingdom, you're not going to start with Enoch. He wasn't a prophet of the kingdom. You're not going to start with Moses. You'll start with Samuel, because he anointed the first king, who was Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. So Saul was the first in Israel's kingdom, just like Paul was the first in the body. And he was also Saul of the tribe of Benjamin. So there is this parallel that God worked out in the lives of these two people. So Samuel is most identified with Israel's kingdom. He anointed the first king, and then he anointed the king whose descendants would include the eternal one, the everlasting king, Jesus Christ. So it is in the book that bears his name, 2 Samuel chapter 7, that we read the prophet saying to David, "When your days are fulfilled, David, and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you." What does that mean, your seed after you? One of your children, one of your sons, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That is a messianic prophecy. It was true of Solomon, because Solomon built the temple, God's house, but that wasn't the primary fulfillment of that prophecy. The primary fulfillment was with the Messiah. That house that Solomon built was eventually destroyed. It was rebuilt by Ezra, and then rebuilt or refurbished again in the time of Herod. So the house that would be eternal would be the house built by Jesus Christ, who was also a descendant of David. That would be the house of Israel, those in the covenant of circumcision who trusted God. They are part of God's eternal kingdom, the house of Israel. Whereas we are members of his body, so we are part of what Paul terms, the household of faith, because we are saved by grace through faith alone. Israel had a covenant of circumcision, and God required of them that they circumcise and that they keep the Sabbath and the dietary law and the baptisms. God required that of them. And if they would have said, well, I believe in God, but I'm not going to circumcise. Beware. God said, if you commit a high-handed sin, a presumptuous sin under the Mosaic law, I will not forgive you. So a big difference between the covenant of law, which was Israel's covenant, and the covenant of grace, which is our covenant. God be praised for what he has done for us. So Solomon is telling King Hiram about the temple that he plans to build. In verse 6, now therefore command that they cut down cedars for me from Lebanon. The cedars of Lebanon, we read about them throughout the Bible. And it's like in America, we think of the redwoods in California and the great sequoias. And when I first traveled to Northern California, I remember driving through one of the redwoods with, I had an old Ford van, an Econoline, 1970. I remember, maybe 69. I remember driving through the tree because they had carved an archway under the tree. Now we've gone there since and they don't let you do that anymore because they're party poopers or they have a good reason for it. I don't know. But we take such pride in a good way in the trees that God has created and how they have been able to grow in the Northwest. They're just awesome. They fill you with awe just seeing them and standing at their base. And so it was the same way in Israel in the Old Testament with the cedars of Lebanon. And so Solomon is saying to the king of Tyre, command that your workers cut down cedars for me from Lebanon. And my servants will be with your servants. I'll provide some of the workforce. And I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say. That's pretty neat, right? That's an indication that they trust one another. Now, when national leaders trust one another, sort of like Reagan said, trust but verify. And it's often the same thing in our own relationships. But there obviously is a degree of trust. And when you could operate on that trust, it enables you to trust even more. And so that's neat. And when people undermine trust, and that makes a marriage relationship difficult, a parent-child, business relationships, and so on. So I will pay you wages according to whatever you say, for you know that there is none among us who has skill to cut timber like the Sidonians. So the Sidonians, you know, today we'd say nobody knows how to make a watch like the Swiss. The Swiss watch is a good watch and chocolate. There are people who have reputations for excellence in certain areas. Now, remember, Solomon is talking to the king of Tyre. So why is he mentioning the Sidonians? Well, they're right up the coast, about 20 miles. So you are the king of a city state with a sphere of influence. And for a long time, Sidon had been the primary power, the geopolitical power in that part of the coast of the Mediterranean. So Tyre was the lesser neighbor, so to speak, sort of like the U.S. and Canada. And imagine if Canada became more powerful than the U.S. Well, Tyre was lesser until the reign of Hiram. And during his 34 years on the throne, a lot changed, including that relationship turned around. And now Tyre was the dominant power. And so the king of Tyre could certainly call upon the Sidonians to get an important project done. And especially seeing that Solomon was offering to pay and pay whatever Hiram asked. So these two kings, neighbors, they apparently trusted one another. When I'm doing business with a friend or a relative, I often find that we end up arguing about the price. And here's how it happens. I need some help at home or wherever. And one of our relatives or friend comes and said, well, I can do this. It's my line. And I can do it. It's just, you know, parts cost $100. And I say, what? I won't pay a dollar less than $300. And they say, no, it's $100. And I say, $300. They say, if you keep saying that, I'm going to lower the price. I say, if you lower it, I'm going to raise the price. And so we argue about who's going to pay what. We start bickering. And that's fun. It's fun when there's love and trust and you want to do more than that person expects of you. Of course, most business cannot be like that because of the human condition, right? Imagine if a store were to say, or you go to eat at Luke's Steakhouse in Arvada, and they say, oh, pay whatever you want, right? They'd run out of steak and they'd have no money and they'd close down. But the kindness that so many have toward our ministry, I don't want to take advantage of that. And they want to help us with their talents. So it ends up being a vicious circle. Verse 7, so it was when Hiram heard the words of Solomon that he rejoiced greatly and said, blessed be the Lord this day, for he has given David a wise son over this great people. Then Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, I have considered the message which you sent me, and I will do all you desire concerning the cedar and cypress logs. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. So they're growing in the forest of Lebanon, which, you know, many coasts, you come to the shoreline, and then there are hills or mountains. If there were no hills at all, it probably wouldn't be the shoreline. You know, it'd probably easily get inundated. Like in Holland, if it wasn't for the dikes that they built. But in Lebanon, the forest, beautiful forests, mighty trees grew in the highlands, in the hills. So Hiram says, my servants shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. First they cut them down, then they transport them to the sea. I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you indicate to me. And that place, we don't know, but it was probably real near Caesarea, a city that thrived in the time of the Lord. So that would be 1,000 years later, almost 900 years later for Caesarea. But I will float them in rafts by the sea to the place you indicate, and we'll have them broken apart there. So Hiram, he's really being nice. He's not saying, all right, I'll cut them down, but you come and get them. I'll cut them down. I'll transport them to the sea. We will build rafts. We will float the rafts to wherever you say along the coast, and then we'll take them apart and put the logs, we'll pile them up on the coast, inland. And then you can take them away, and you shall fulfill my desire by giving food for my household. So here I'm saying, okay, and I'll accept your offer of payment, and you could pay me in food. He could have asked for gold or silver. He said, feel free. I know Israel's prosperous. Even today, this little nation the size of New Jersey can probably feed much of the Middle East, especially if they didn't have to put so much of the resources into military defense. But they have made the desert blossom with their industriousness. God said, labor 6 days, on the seventh day you rest. And that ethic, even for unbelieving Jews, has helped them become very prosperous. And so I like how he would float them in rafts to save on transportation costs. I love the ingenuity that men use to get things done. So they had millions of pounds of timber, and Hiram's engineers used water to transport all that. Now, this is called log driving. At least it is in America and Europe. And we obviously inherited the idea from the ancients, who were smart, brilliant geniuses. And they were doing this in the Middle East at this time. Now, the logging industry here and in Europe, they would fell the trees and they would transport them over lakes, but they really liked it when they were near rivers because the river is flowing. So they would fell the trees and put them in the river. They didn't even have to make rafts. They'd put them in one at a time even, and ultimately hundreds or thousands. And they'd go down river. They'd have men, when they get stuck, giving them a boost. And they would transport them, the timber, to sawmills or pulp mills from the forest. And that practice ended in the U.S. about 30 to 40 years ago, thanks to the environmentalists. Now, again, I don't know their exact motive, but one thing I do know is they hate when we use renewable resources like wood. They hate that. It's a renewable resource, you know. You cut down a tree, you have a seed, plant it, grows a new tree. They seem to hate that. So they fought to end log driving, and today it would only happen as a part of a celebration or something, like on a July 4th weekend. They do that for fun. So verse 10, then Hiram gave Solomon cedar and cypress logs according to all his desire. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household and 20 cores of pressed oil. Thus Solomon gave to Hiram year by year. So this was an ongoing building supply service that was being provided. And Solomon paid this. This is a lot. This is a lot of dollars worth of foodstuffs. You guys might remember how much a core is. We covered that in the last chapter, I think it was. Right? Remember, a core is 10 ephahs. So there you have it. Oh, wait, what's an ephah? Oh, yeah. An ephah is one bath. So there you have it. Well, and a bath is about 6 gallons. So a core is about 60 gallons. And that means 20,000 cores of wheat. That's about 38,000 barrels of wheat, of grain. And he also gave him 20 cores of extra virgin olive oil. That would equal 1,200 gallons a year of olive oil. Verse 12. So the Lord gave Solomon wisdom, as he had promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon. And the two of them made a treaty together. So they said, hey, we're not going to fight one another. And if somebody attacks us, we'll join forces and we'll defend one another. We have a Bible study on treaties, an entire, you know, hour or hour and a half on treaties. It's part of our verse by verse study of the book of Joshua, chapter 9. We go through, we try to look at the biblical principles regarding treaties so that nations today could benefit if they understood the biblical principles of governance. Our U.S. Constitution says something that's almost brilliant. It says that treaties are an equal authority, the supreme law of the land in America, along with the Constitution. Now, that's almost brilliant. So the supreme law of the land is the Constitution and treaties. I think it would bump up to brilliant if they said that treaties preempt the Constitution. Because the greatest priority for a nation as far as fulfilling its obligations would not be its internal obligations, but be to fulfill the obligations you made to your neighbor. And that's true of you too and your family. I'll give an illustration. If Cheryl and I have an agreement that every Thursday night, that's date night, We are not going to do any work. We're just going to enjoy one another's company. And that, and for years, Thursday night, no work. Boy, that'd be fun, wouldn't it, honey? But separately, not thinking anything about date night, we agree to help our neighbor clean out his attic and his basement because he's moving. He's moving and he needs to sell his home and get out of it. And the last time available to finish that project is Thursday night. It's either Thursday night or we don't do it. We don't get it done. So would it be right for us to say, we know we told you that we'd help, but we're so sorry we can't help. That would violate our agreement we have. Can't do it. Would that be right? Of course not. Because a promise you make to yourself is subordinate to a promise you make to someone else. External agreements take precedence over internal agreements, but ultimately the greatest priority and obligation is to obey God in any agreement we have with God. Whether we agreed with God or he imposed it on us, that takes precedence over all agreements. The Constitution, treaties, your internal house rules, the, you know, eight ball, if you play eight ball, and what are the house rules? You have to call the shot before you sink it. Do you, if you sink the eight ball early, do you lose automatically? Whatever the house rules are, if they included cheating, you could cheat if somebody's not looking, that would violate God's rule. So your internal rules need to give way to your external rules, and even they need to give way to God's rules. Jesus, remember Jesus said, don't swear. Peter and Paul said the same thing. Don't swear that you will do something. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. And I believe that a Christian theologian who's advising a king would do well to counsel him not to enter into treaties. Don't enter into treaties. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. And if you have a neighbor who's being unjustly attacked, go to his defense. And let all the nations of the world know that if you are able to, you will try to defend the innocent and oppose and even stop the aggressors if you're able to. Verse 13. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel. And the labor force was 30,000 men. That's a labor force, 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon and 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. And by the way, the ancient calendars were a cause of tremendous turmoil. When God created 30 days every month, the moon would make a complete orbit, 12 months exactly every year. You do something every month, you take turns, it all works out perfectly. What do you want to bet? Some of these workers were angry because they got stuck on the longer month. And all these other guys got shorter month. He worked in February and I'm stuck in August. And it's a lot hotter in August. The February short month and the longer month, that wasn't established till later. Augustus Caesar wanted his month of August to have more days because he's Caesar. So he gave it 31. And then Julius Caesar was envious. So he wanted July to have 31. So they took a couple days from February. So February got ripped off because it didn't have a king to defend itself. So this Adoniram, he was in charge of the labor force. He was a tax collector in ancient Israel for decades, starting with David through to Solomon's reign and beyond. And he eventually was stoned to death. As Solomon wrote, there's nothing new under the sun, right? Hatred for the IRS goes way back, way, way back. And we'll see more of Adoniram. Solomon started wonderfully. but he ended miserably in horrific idolatry, adultery, utter rebellion. You don't get 1,000 women in your harem by their own volition. So it was a real tragic story. And as I said earlier, and we'll see more of this, but he's most likely in hell right now. Verse 15, Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens and 80,000 who quarried stone in the mountains. Sounding like Pharaoh, isn't it? Besides 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. So there were a lot of supers, a lot of supervisors. And the king commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, and hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. That is too expensive today. We don't do much of that. We build great buildings out of little stones because the big stones are really expensive. King Herod, who was 800 years after this, more than 850 years later, he built the wall around the Temple Mount so he could make a great temple and a great temple complex. And Mount Moriah, it wasn't big enough for him. So he made it bigger by building, we think of the Western Wall, and then it goes across the south and up the east and across the north, and he made a big rectangle. And to give you an idea, this room that we're in, if you think of a rock from that wall to about here, about this high, the whole way to that wall, that's about the size of one of the rocks at the base of the Western Wall. There's a tour you could go through. We've gone through with our Bible tours of Israel, and it's astounding what they were able to do. They were brilliant. It might be a bit harder for us to quarry the same kinds of stones because the low-hanging fruit, they took a lot of the best rock. And then when those cities fell, earthquakes happened, or like in AD 70, General Titus destroyed the city of Jerusalem and burned and knocked over the walls. He was determined to not let one stone be left unturned. Every building would be knocked down. Every wall knocked down. He got to the Temple Mount and the Western Wall. And he said, well, not that one. It's just, we'll be here for 20 years trying to knock that wall down. So this king commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, and hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. So Solomon's builders, Haran's builders, and the Gebalites quarried them, and they prepared timber and stones to build the temple. So the preparation was underway. May God bless you guys.
Hi, this is Nicole McBurney again, wrapping up today's episode of Theology Thursday. But before you take off, I want to remind you that the only thing keeping us on air is you. Broadcasting is not cheap, so if you like what you're hearing, please go to kgov.com/donations. That's kgov.com/donations. Or you can go to the store to get some great resources at kgov.com/store. We really appreciate all of your support, and be sure to tune in tomorrow for Real Science Radio with Fred Williams. God bless.